I was in the middle of the United States. It's very flat. The weather is generally hostile. It's either very hot in the summer or very, very cold and snowy in the winter. And it just seemed to me growing up that this was a really dull, it's like serving a very long prison sentence.
Escaping from Iowa in the American Midwest was what triggered Bill Bryson's desire to travel. He first went round Europe before settling in England and for the past few years has lived in North Yorkshire. Recently, though, he decided to revisit his native country. Starting out in Iowa, near the centre of the United States, he made two big loops to east and west, driving some 14,000 miles in his mother's old Chevette. When I asked him, had he first got a sense of a bigger world outside his hometown of Des Moines?
I can remember the actual turning point was watching a television program one Sunday afternoon. It was a documentary about filmmaking in Europe. And they showed Anthony Perkins walking down some street in Paris, or possibly Rome, but it was a cobbled street. It was shiny with rain. He had his Burberry on, and he turned the collar up. There was just something about it that absolutely, maybe 8, 9 years old. From that moment on, I was just hooked. I just thought there's another world out there that I want to be part of.
And yet, there you were in small town America, and now you've gone back to small town America. Having escaped it, you decided to make a journey back there. What was the appeal of going back?
Well, what happened, and it was that my father had died, and when I went home for the funeral, it's the first time I'd gone back on my own. It suddenly occurred to me then that America had become almost like a foreign country to me.
How long had you been away at that stage?
I'd been away for about 10 years consecutively, but I'd lived here for 2 years before that, so I'd been away for 12 out of the last 14 years. It just suddenly struck me that America was, I felt alien there in a way I never had before. And it occurred to me that it would be an interesting experience to borrow my mother's old car and hit the highway and just see how both the country had changed and how I had changed in the period since I was growing up there in the 50s and 60s.
I mean, in terms of travel, Bill, I mean, nobody could really accuse you of being a very rugged traveller on this journey. This is true, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. Some of the motels I stayed in, I thought, yes, no, you're right. It's absolutely true. I was driving a Chevette. I was staying in motels. And I was on a very, very limited budget, very tight budget. America is not like Biafra or something. I mean, it's obviously a very comfortable, easy country to get around in.
But you were, in fact, travelling as the natives do, in a sense.
That's right.
And once you get out on the open road, what sort of visual stimulus did you find? Because there's an awful lot of open road.
One of the things I really loved when I was growing up were the billboards in America, you know, the hoardings along the highways, which everybody agreed in the 60s that they were hideously ugly. And in fact, Lady Bird Johnson made it a campaign to get rid of them. And they did get rid of them all over the country. They've kind of disappeared. And I thought it was a really sad loss because in places like Nebraska and Iowa, where it's just flat and empty, billboards were actually about the only visual stimulation you got. And a lot of them were actually very clever or at least very arresting. Very often they would have some three-dimensional element to them. If it was a dairy that they were advertising, there would be a cow's head actually jutting out of the billboard coming out at you. Or if it was for a bowling alley, there'd be 10 pins scattering, but they would actually be cut out above the top of the board. You know, there was this kind of, they were arresting. They were, and as I say, that was almost in places like Nebraska all you got. Now you drive across Nebraska and you see, or South Dakota, or many of these other flatter, more empty states, and you see really virtually nothing. Nebraska is like the world's first drive-through sensory deprivation chamber. And it is. I mean, it's just nothing. You just hour after hour of going down these roads that are as straight as an arrow and nothing much happening on either side of them.
So you were listening to the radio or something, were you?
Well, I was trying to, but again, the problem, and this was a particular problem, my mother's car, because it was a very cheap Chevette and had one of the world's crummiest radios in it. And you could only get stations for like 5 minutes. And so I'd be listening to some, you know, nice old Beatles song or something, and it would fade out, and then there'd suddenly be this semi-demented religious maniac telling me that I had a friend in God or something, and I'd have to start twiddling the dial again, and I'm doing that over and over again, and that in itself became very tedious.
I was only slowly adjusting to the continental scale of America, where states are the size of countries. There's so much emptiness, so much space between towns. The whole business of finding your way around becomes laden with frustration, especially away from the main roads. The highway authorities are curiously reluctant to impart much in the way of useful information, like where you are or what road you're on. This is all the more strange when you consider that they are only too happy to provide all kinds of peripheral facts. Now entering Bubb County Soil Conservation District. National Sprat Hatchery, 5 miles. No parking, Wednesday 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. Danger, low-flying geese. Now leaving Bubb County Soil Conservation District. Often on country roads, you'll come to a crossroads without signposts, and then have to drive 20 miles or more without having any confidence in where you are. And then, abruptly, without warning, you round a bend and find yourself at an 8-lane intersection with 14 traffic lights and the most bewildering assortment of signs, all with arrows pointing in different directions. Lake Maggot State Park this way. Curtis Dribble Memorial Expressway over there. Junction 17 west. Junction 17 not west. No U-turn. Left lane must turn left. Buckle your seatbelt. Sit up straight. Did you brush your teeth this morning?
When you got out into the Smoky Mountain National Park, was this at last unspoilt nature?
Well, yes, but it was too unspoilt. That was the problem. I mean, it's very, very beautiful. You know, you come around a bend and you're rewarded with these landscapes, these vistas that just go on and on, these rolling hills. Very, very beautiful mountains, very green, covered with trees right up to the top. You know, not craggy at all, but just gentle, beautiful mountains, and you can see for miles. And one of the things that struck me was looking out on this landscape is that you didn't see a house jutting up through the trees, or a wraith of smoke rising from anywhere, or any sign of habitation at all. It seemed very, very sterile and unreal, because what it really lacked was people living there, making it, using the land the way they do everywhere else on the planet, and the way they once did.
No walkers, no hitchhikers, no
very,
bicycles.
Very few. There are some there, and they do have footpaths which are used. There's a long-distance footpath which goes right up the eastern seaboard of the United States and does go through the Smoky Mountains National Park. But you don't see people out walking the way you do in Europe. People didn't seem to be taking advantage of that. Most people I saw were in these massive, hideous motorhomes. And very often they were driving around and not even emerging from them, as if they were in some kind of sealed unit. As if they were allergic to fresh air.
But that, in a way, was very typical, it seemed to me, of what you found on your whole journey. To be characteristic of the Americans was to seal themselves off from the first experience with air conditioning or whatever it happened to be.
Yeah, I think that's the one most basic difference between America and Europe, is that Americans tend to think in terms of the interior. You go to a shopping mall in America, and to see it from the street, it's almost always a hideous expanse of parking spaces, you know, enough parking for thousands of cars, and these very architecturally uninviting flat-roofed buildings. Then you go inside and it's wonderful. It's all tropical rainforest with fountains and escalators, and it's all really, really very nice. Whereas in Europe, of course, it's, generally speaking, it's the other way around. Particularly in Britain, I think, you go and you see these wonderful old buildings on the outside, and then you go inside and they've been completely destroyed by some architect who's modernized them and turned them into something fairly plasticky and horrible. But at least from the outside, they have the integrity they had originally.
You had a lovely sentence, in fact, about all this, which seemed to me to sum it up rather well, maybe rather unkind on America, but you say, America never quite grasped that you could live in a place without making it ugly. That's a very damning statement.
Yes, but... I do feel very strongly about it. It's always been a disappointment to me that America has been the richest country in the world for a very long time. It's assembled an amount of wealth that's just staggering compared with what the rest of the world has. Even now, it's got 4% of the people, and it uses 25% of the world's energy, 25% of the oil. Amazing. I mean, the wealth there is just, it's, even now, it's just fabulous. And it seemed to me that so much of it's been wasted on just sort of instant gratification and not on building anything lasting. It's always seemed to me that other countries build civilizations, America builds shopping centers. And I think that's very, very sad.
This was interesting too, because in a way a leitmotif of your travels, or sort of markers, were birthplaces and death places of individuals. There weren't great cathedrals or anything like that. You were finding your way by where Presley died, where Bill Cody lived, and so on.
Yeah.
Which it seemed to me very characteristic of America.
Well, yes, it is. I mean, you have to, obviously you're dealing with a much shorter time scale of history, so there isn't the wealth of heritage to deal with. There is, in the East Coast, there is more and more. You kind of spend a year or 2 years or whatever, just going around from one historic home to another. But just the further west you move, the less you get of that. And you have to sort of content yourself with with things like Elvis Presley's birthplace, which in American terms is really quite a historic shrine. So is Eisenhower's home at Gettysburg. I mean, he only lived there in the 50s and 60s, but it's still treated like a national historic. In fact, I think it's called a National Historic Monument or residence or whatever. And you find that again and again all over America. That's their kind of answer to the stately homes and palaces that you find in Britain.
Between about 1890 and 1905, America's richest families, the Vanderbilts, the Astors, the Belmonts, dozens of others, try to outdo each other by building magnificent homes, which they insisted on calling cottages, all along this half-mile strip of imposing cliffs. Most were loosely modeled on French chateaux and are now run as museums. You can't see much from the street. The owners didn't want common people staring at them as they sat on the lawn counting their money, so they put up dense hedges and high walls. But I discovered, quite by chance, that the city had built an asphalt footpath all along the cliff edge from which I could see the backs of the grander mansions, as well as enjoying giddying views of the ocean breaking onto the rocks far below. I had the path almost to myself and walked along it in a state of quiet amazement with my mouth open. Every house looked like a cross between a wedding cake and a state capitol building. I knew that the grandest of all the houses was the Breakers built by the Vanderbilts, and I kept thinking, well, this must be it. And now surely this must be it. But then the next house along would be even more awesome. When at last I reached the Breakers, it was absolutely enormous. A mountain with windows. You can't look at it without thinking that nobody, with the possible exception of oneself, deserves to be that rich.
You're also quite seduced by that the sort of kitsch aspect of America yourself. You found, going back to it, that it had its appeal.
Sure. I think it does. When I was growing up, my father always forbade us to go to places like Gatlinburg in Tennessee, which is a town on the other side of the Smoky Mountains, which is just absolutely dedicated to kitsch and to delivering the sort of tawdriest experience possible to any visitor to the place. It's just full of places selling candy floss and just all kinds of, every kind of tacky item you've ever seen is there, and every kind of tacky amusement, Guinness World Records museums and Dolly Parton Hall of Fame type places, all that is there. And I just adored it because when I was growing up and my father was taking us on our summer vacations, he would always speed through these places, both because he thought it was offensive, aesthetically offensive, but also because he was so cheap that he didn't want to have to pay out all the money that it would cost to take us to all these places. So I was just in heaven to find myself in places like this and able to go and voluntarily spend my money on Ripley's Believe It or Not museums and things like that.
What was in there?
Oh, everything. It was wonderful. It was one of the high points of the trip. I mean, possibly one of the high points of my life. It was great. It was just all the stuff. I mean, I grew up always reading Ripley's Believe It or Not books. And these museums were scattered all over the country. So every vacation you would encounter them. And as I say, my dad would always say no. And so I had this very strong, long, enduring urge to go in one of these places. And it was just full of just things. There was a photograph of a guy who could put 3 billiard balls in his mouth at once. This is, you know, I mean, this is not the sort of thing you encounter at
more
cultural places, yeah.
You went on then to the White House. Was this the first time you'd ever been to the White House?
Yes, in fact, well, the second time I'd been there, I didn't go in this time. In fact, we didn't go in on previous occasion, but I did just stand outside it and look at it.
And was it surprising to you in any way?
Well, the White House itself surprised me because it was smaller than I expected. I think everybody sees it says that. It doesn't look as grand as not nearly as overwhelming as Buckingham Palace, say. It doesn't have that same imposing scale. Also, the fact that it's just downtown. I mean, you're just sort of walking along, looking in department store windows, and you turn a corner, and there suddenly smacking you in the face, so to speak, is the White House. But what really I found arresting about the White House is the fact that just outside it now, it is just full. The sidewalks are full of lunatics and vagrants and people who are on some sort of demented mission that they feel that the FBI is tapping into their brains or whatnot. I mean, scores of these people camped out in a little park just opposite the White House and all along outside the gate. And they're there because it's one of the constitutional freedoms you can enjoy in America is not only to be crazy, but to demonstrate in a public place about your insanity. And there were lots of people there who, and lots of panhandlers, some people that were, you know, just...
What's a panhandler?
Oh, a person who's begging you for money. Or in Washington, actually, a person who's demanding money from you. You don't treat them as beggars because it's more like a sort of an agreed mugging. I mean, it's.
Then came a high point for you in Detroit. You visited something called the Henry Ford Museum. What was this one full of?
It is the most wonderful museum in America, I think. One of the most wonderful museums in the world. Henry Ford was an inveterate collector of Americana. He went out and bought the childhood homes of people like Harvey Firestone and Thomas Edison. Or in Edison's case, he bought the laboratories from Menlo Park, New Jersey. All these famous places, Abraham Lincoln's cabin and all that kind of stuff. And he took them all back to this very beautiful setting in Dearborn, which is where the main Ford factory is, and reassembled them and made them into this kind of fictitious American village. As if, you know, Abraham Lincoln grew up next door to Benjamin Franklin or whatever like that. Amazing place. And these are the genuine homes just reassembled so that you can have the experience of actually seeing Edison's labs or the Wright brothers' house from Akron, Ohio. The genuine things in sequence. I mean, you can just wander around and see them all right there and sort of get it all over and done with in a day rather than have to go to all the different places all over the country. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is that under in these vast hangars, he's also, he and his heirs have assembled this huge assemblage of just odds and ends from American history, things, some of them fairly macabre and bizarre, like the car that Kennedy was riding in when he was assassinated.
Yes.
And then collections of milk bottles, collections of Coca-Cola bottles. They rebuilt, when I was there, they were in the process of rebuilding an entire McDonald's as it looked in the 1950s. All these things that if you grew up in America in any time in the last 60 or 70 years, it just brings all these memories racing back.
One thing that struck me, Bill, was that your mental map of America, like I imagine probably every American's, is very much composed of movies. Kansas, which you next went to, was full of references like this.
Yeah, so Kansas is one of probably the most typical American state, if such a statement isn't completely nonsensical. But I mean, it is in the sense that that was where Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz came from. That's where it was set. Superman came from Kansas. And you know, it's kind of the all-American state. And odd, really, that it should be, because it's very flat, very, very physically unmemorable. I mean, there's really, it's as flat as you can get. It's like being on a tabletop.
Every 10 miles or so, there's a side road. And at every side road, there's an old pickup truck stopped at a stop sign. You can see him from a long way off. In Kansas, you can see everything from a long way off, glinting in the sunshine. At first, you think the truck must be broken down or abandoned. But just as you get within 30 or 40 feet of it, it pulls out onto the highway in front of you, causing you to make an immediate downward adjustment in your speed from 60 miles an hour to about 12 miles an hour, and to test the resilience of the steering wheel with your forehead. Well, this happens to you over and over. I'm curious to see what sort of person could inconvenience you in this way in the middle of nowhere. You speed up to overtake it, and see that sitting at the wheel is a little old man of 87, wearing a cowboy hat three sizes too large for him, staring fixedly at the empty road as if piloting a light aircraft through a thunderstorm. He is, of course, quite oblivious of you. Kansas has more drivers like this than any other state in the nation, more than can be accounted for by simple demographics. Other states must send them their old people, perhaps by promising them a free cowboy hat when they get there.
In California, you had a tremendous sense of déjà vu of the landscape. Again, for a reason associated with films.
Oh, that's right. Well, I was just sort of blundering around in the hills a little to the north of Los Angeles. And I mean, all I was trying to do really was avoid going into Los Angeles. And I was trying to follow back roads. I mean, all the roads want to take you into Los Angeles, which is exactly what I didn't want to do. So I was trying to go kind of cross country and avoid Los Angeles. And in doing so, I stumbled out into this countryside where there's a lot of citrus groves and low, rather sparse hills. And fairly appealing countryside. And what struck me just instantly about it, an amazing sense of realization, was that this is exactly the setting where all the 1950s cowboy movies, cowboy television programs were filmed, films like The Cisco Kid and Bat Masterson and Gunsmoke and The Lone Ranger. And the landscape was exactly, and I suddenly realized that, of course, when they made movies, Western movies, they actually went to the real locations. They went to you know, Wyoming and Nevada and places further afield. But when they were filming television programs, because of the smaller budgets, they only just really drove to the outskirts of Los Angeles. And if you look back on some of these programs now, you can actually see citrus groves in the background, which obviously, you know, Matt Dillon would never have seen a lemon tree in his life. And it struck me as very odd that it was so strange to see this landscape that was, I'd never been to it before, but it was so deeply familiar.
Another arresting feature in a movie was Mount Rushmore, these great big sculpted heads of the presidents.
Yeah, Mount Rushmore is a place that I really adored, and I think his name is Borglum, the man who constructed it. It's just it's an amazing achievement.
Why did he construct it? What reason was there?
Well, he was just a sculptor who wanted to do something of a truly monumental scale that had never been done before. And, I mean, he just took the side of a mountain and blasted it away with dynamite in this amazing way. They show you footage in the visitor center at Mount Rushmore of it being constructed. And it's the most amazing thing, because the films show these happy, smiling workmen packing dynamite into this rock face, and then they all sort of run for cover, and it blows up, and there suddenly is George Washington, or something rather like George Washington. And you think, you know, what a genius to figure out how you can sort of blast away a mountain
That's
and have it come out looking like a person. Amazing. Even when you're there, you cannot appreciate just how vast these things are. Like, you could put a small house up Washington's nostril or something like that. You realize just what an epic achievement this was. And the very sad thing is that he built this, they finished it off, and they really almost within a week or a couple of weeks, a very short period, he died. I mean, he just finished this work, and then he just dropped dead unexpectedly of a heart attack.
Yes, but he knew he'd done it. So
he didn't, yes, at least he finished it. But, you know, you would have thought it would have been nice if he could have had a few years to gaze at it and appreciate exactly what he'd achieved. But it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
In fact, you brought back a souvenir from there.
Yeah, see, all the time I was traveling around, I was very tempted to buy, I wanted to buy some kind of kitschy souvenir in every state I passed through, because there are plenty of them on offer, believe me. And I had the problem that I couldn't afford, because souvenirs tend to be kind of expensive, and also I couldn't carry everything. I went through 38 states, 38 souvenirs would be quite a lot to pack away in a suitcase. But I did, when I got to Mount Rushmore, I was nearly at the end of the trip, and I thought, I haven't really bought a good souvenir. And I bought this little kerosene lantern. It's in the shape of Mount Rushmore. And, I mean, I'm just thrilled with it even now. Most people think that it's very bizarre and stupid, but I think it's just wonderful. And the great thing about it is that it was made in Japan.
Perhaps it ought to be the start of Bill Bryson Believe It or Not Museum in Yorkshire.
Yes, I would love to do that, yes.
Before you went up to Mount Rushmore, you'd visited Las Vegas, which you had to.
As you say, it's something that you can't go out that part of the country and not visit it. And Las Vegas was a place that was strange to me, because I was enchanted with it. I mean, it is so captivating. It's so full of glitter and neon and excitement. And to get there, you have to realize, to get there by car involves a lot of driving, very hard driving from almost any direction. So when you get there, you're finally reaching this, it's quite literally an oasis in the desert. And it's just, you know, you can see it from miles off, and it's just this most arresting sight. Nowhere in the world is there a greater concentration of neon and you know, glitter and all that kind of stuff. And everything is cheap and available and instant gratification everywhere you go. And I was greatly charmed by this for about an hour, hour and a half, and then I really very quickly came to despise it. I hated it. It's all a huge con built around the idea that people will put money into machines or lay money, you know, spend money on their own greed, on trying to satisfy this urge to get back more than they've paid in. And, of course, all the odds are hugely stacked against them. And it seemed to me it only took about 10 minutes to realize that you're going to come out a loser.
But you saw nobody having fun there, so it didn't...
I know, that was the other thing that struck me, was how sort of stern and severe and grim people looked. Even people who won. I mean, I can remember I put in some money with one of the first coins I put in, and I got back like 50 cents or $2 or some small payout. And I was looking around proudly, like everybody was going to be paying attention to, you know, like that I was going to get a little cheer from all the people at nearby slot machines. And there was nobody paid any attention to me. And I was watching people, I saw some woman win, it must have been a couple of $1,000 in coins, which is a huge volume of coins, believe me. And she seemed to take absolutely no satisfaction from this at all. It looked as if it was a punishment, because she would have to now start feeding all these coins back into this machine. You know, there was just this constant repetitive dropping coins into a machine and pulling a crank. And I find it very odd. It just didn't appeal to me at all.
So you left Las Vegas gladly?
Yes.
And went back to Iowa through the Northwest. lots of empty states, or relatively empty in European standards.
Yeah, relatively empty in lunar standards. I mean, they're just empty. There's just nothing there. And I spend a lot of time out in the West driving and driving and driving and then driving some more. I mean, and you get roads that are some roads where the highway will not deviate a fraction of an inch. It's as straight as a die for 50 miles maybe. That is a long distance. It's the sort of distance that doesn't sound very much until you actually start driving it. But to go for an hour or so without even making the most fractional adjustment of your steering wheel is really an amazing experience. And it gets to you after a while. Believe me, it really is becomes very tedious indeed. The problem with the West is that so much of it is very beautiful, but it's the space, the scale of it. And you see the mountains that, like, and they start to appear on the horizon at 9 in the morning. And then you drive for 4 hours and they seem to be the same distance away. You constantly don't have this sense of gaining on them. And you are, of course, but you don't get the visual reward you do in other countries where you see something and then pretty soon you're there.
You also have an interesting comment about the settlers or the people who arrived in America, that most of the mad people went west.
Well, it seems to be a fact. I mean, you never see people hitchhiking in the east in America. Everybody who's crazy in America has this urge, which I couldn't begin to explain, but this urge to go west, to go to the west coast. And they've been doing it ever since, at least the period since Hollywood's been around. People want to go out and become a star, or they want to, whatever crazy scheme they have, they gravitate to the west coast, and particularly to Southern California. So you have this huge buildup of lunatic types wandering the streets of Los Angeles. It's one reason why I steered clear of Los Angeles. And it's very true. I mean, but you see people hitchhiking along the highways all over the western half of America, and they're always going in one direction. They never get out there and say, oh, God, this is terrible. Let's go back to, you know, Boston. They stay out. I don't know why. I suppose the sunshine or something. The company of other lunatics. I don't know what it is, but it seems to be pretty well an immutable fact.
And what about Iowa when you came back to it? How did you feel about it? Because you'd set off initially to come home to the States, which you'd left, and you did feel that sense of homecoming then after this long trip, did you? You didn't feel it was more alien as a place?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I felt, as you say, when you grow up in a place, you feel a relationship to it that is very fundamental, very profound. And I understand America intimately. I understand how it works. I understand the way people are talking, the foods they eat. There's no sense of being a foreigner in any way like that. But at the same time, I feel as if I've grown away from America and that I'm not, not only am I not physically connected with it, but I'm not emotionally connected to it in the same way I was when I was growing up. And it was this odd juxtaposition to me is constantly driving around. On one hand, I would sometimes feel as if I'd really come home, and at the other time, sort of feeling as if you can't go home again, you know. And I could never quite make up my mind which I was doing or which was happening to me. And I think it was really a mixture of the two.
The Art of Travel, Bill Bryson, was presented by Annette Kobach, produced by Kate McCall, and first broadcast on BBC Radio 4 on the 27th of January 1991.